And speaking of something to talk about, let's say it's getting a little uncomfortably quiet at your Thanksgiving dinner and you could use a conversation starter. Well, anthropologist Logan Kistler's got your back just in time for the pie. Hey, Logan.
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so mathematically speaking, pumpkin pie is kind of a miracle, right? Like, meaning it's pretty weird that pumpkins and squashes are sweet and edible at all. Can you explain?
Yeah, to get into this, you kind of have to think about what pumpkins look like before they were pumpkins. So every food species that we eat, you know, it's domesticated. It looks different. It's been under the influences of thousands of years of human evolution. And so pumpkins in the wild, they're about the size of tennis balls, and they're really tough. The rind is very thick. It's very difficult to open. And they taste terrible. They're really bitter. They actually contain the bitterest naturally occurring substances known to humans, and they're toxic.
Oh.
So it's not really a very attractive food stuff.
Yeah. So, but pumpkins are fruits, right? Meaning they have seeds. So they need animals to eat them, to break them open and get the seeds and, you know, digest the fruit and then expel the seeds. So if they're gross tasting and they're toxic, how do they survive?
So they're gross tasting and toxic to humans and to small mammals. But if you rewind the clock about 15,000 years in the Americas where these things grow wild, you had large herbivores, things like mastodons, woolly mammoths, and lots of other these exotic large species that went extinct sort of at the end of the last ice age. And in Florida, there's actually deposits that are mastodon dung deposits that are full of 30,000-year-old mastodon dung. And if you look in there, sure enough, what we find are wild squash seeds. So it seems like these things that are bitter tasting and terrible to us actually had this relationship with wild or large mastodons and possibly other these large plant-eating species so they could disperse those. What we think this has to do with is body size and how much this animal has to eat. So if you're a mastodon, think of an elephant now. These are animals that have to eat approaching 200 pounds of food a day of plant matter. And so they're sort of wandering through the savanna or wandering through the forest, and they're just kind of vacuuming up everything in sight. You know, they're really, really feeding on a lot of plant material, and they can't afford to be picky eaters. And so in evolutionary terms, when we taste something bitter, that signals to us that it's toxic. We're supposed to spit that out. That's how we detect dangerous compounds. But these very large animals, if they were detecting every slightly toxic compound, it wouldn't do them any good because those don't pose so much of a threat when they're eating so much food. And in fact, it would actually be harmful to them. But if you look at something on the other end of the spectrum, look at a mouse or even small primates that eat a lot of different types of food, they're sampling throughout the environment, they're eating a lot of different kinds of plants, and a small amount of a toxic substance could be really harmful. And so actually, large animals have a greater tolerance for bitterness than small ones do. So even though this sort of tennis ball-shaped, horrible-tasting thing is no good to us, it's very attractive to large mammals.
So what happened then? Mastodons eventually died off. What came to love these things then?
Yeah, so mastodons, they were part of a lot of extinction events that happened in the Americas around sort of 10 to 12 to 15,000 years ago. And this is a combination of factors. Humans are showing up sort of around this time, and they're certainly hunting some of these animals. In addition to that, there are climate change events going on at that time. So the ecosystem is essentially changing too fast, and these large mammals go extinct. In fact, there's none of these really, really huge herbivores left in North or South America now. But so after these things wink out in what we call the end of the Pleistocene, then the squashes have a problem. They don't have a disperser anymore. And not only that, but these wild plants prefer disturbed landscapes. And elephants, you know, when they're feeding on 100 or 200 pounds of food a day, they're really affecting the landscape.
Sorry, by disturbed landscape, you mean like literally, oh, the elephants are huge. Mastodons are huge.
Yep.
And they're just like squashing stuff.
They are shredding the landscape. They're eating a lot of stuff in sight. And we can see this. We can look at, for example, pollen from lake cores going through thousands of years. And when you see large herbivores disappear, you see a change in the forest composition. You get these much more homogeneous sort of landscapes that are much more similar to what we see now.
Oh, interesting. And then so how do they become something that, I mean, you know, fast forward, spoiler alert, we love to eat these things now. How did they come to be something that humans love eating?
So essentially, because humans also mess around with the landscape, you know, we clear space for growing food, you know, we clear space around houses for protection. We really do change the ecosystem around us. And that's kind of a substitute environment for these wild plants. So these wild plants kind of cozy up to humans beginning around 10,000 years ago. And this doesn't happen once. It happens on six different occasions throughout North and South America. And so they sort of enter into this evolutionary partnership with humans, where humans are providing a environment in which these wild plants can grow. But then this whole relationship goes a step farther, because humans still can't use this plant at this time. It's still bitter and toxic. But the plant then makes a few evolutionary concessions. So whereas being tough and bitter was a good characteristic for their purposes in the company of mastodons, it doesn't work for humans. And so they lose that hard rind, and they develop soft flesh, and they lose that toxicity and become sweet. So over time, the evolution of those characters benefits those plants in the long run, because it makes them more attractive to humans, who then plant them year on year and provide a favorable environment that they can thrive in.
Yeah. So at some point, like, some great ancestor found one of these wild squashes that, this one doesn't make me feel terrible when I eat it. So they ate it, and they took those seeds, and maybe those seeds were dispersed, and so those grew, and more people found that one. And so it was like there was one random mutation, and then humans sort of glommed onto that, and then, like you said, there was this sort of like evolutionary, I guess symbiosis isn't the word. What would you call that when you're sort of like partners in evolution?
Symbiosis is exactly the word.
Oh, really? Right on.
Yeah,
good
that's
job,
exactly
Lamb.
How it would
So it becomes this evolutionary symbiosis, and eventually we have pumpkins that are sweet and delicious and show up in our pies on Thanksgiving.
That's exactly right.
That's so fascinating.
And at the beginning of that process, that's one of the sort of black boxes left, that we don't really know what that first, tasty pumpkin looked like, or how the first parts of that process got underway. It might have been for the seeds. They're a little bit less bitter. We also have archaeological situations where people were using these wild squashes to float fish nets. So they're using them in other ways and using them as containers before they can eat them. And then, it's exactly like you say. Somebody perhaps happens on one that's a little bit more palatable, and then they kind of influence that over time into what we have now.
Yeah. Now we mix it with a whole pile of spices and forget what the pumpkin tastes like anyway.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Logan. This is super, super interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Logan Kistler is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And if now you feel like eating pumpkins, you can go to splendidtable.org and get a great recipe from Donna Hay for roasted pumpkin and chorizo salad.